This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 28th of October, 1955. The title of this lecture is The Anatomy of Terminals. This lecture is 55 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
The materials of processing are important materials to the auditor. They are as good as they are understood. They are as good as their goals are understood, and they are as workable as they are used with understanding. It's very well to have a mechanical process which produces certain definite results with an individual to a large degree and an astonishing degree. The mechanisms of Scientology will produce at this time a result with an individual even when carried forward mechanically without much understanding. However, the best part of man is that part of man which understands. The worst part of man is that part of man which won't understand. A psychosomatic illness is something that won't understand. If man has a psychosomatic illness in his leg of some kind or another, remember that it is the illness that doesn't understand, not the leg. We can throw communication at the area. We are actually more likely to unmock the leg than we are to unmock the illness. Why? The leg understands, the illness does not understand. This should be very observable to you, that body parts disappear under the onslaught of psychosomatics and diseases. The individual, in trying to communicate with the disease, communicates with that which is more native to him and in closer agreement with him and with the body in general, which is the body part. He communicates with the body part and compounds or creates or carries forward the progress of the disease. This is an interesting principle. If you see this principle clearly, you will see a great deal about illness and its inability to surrender. Let us say that we have an infection eating away at a person. This infection is foreign to the individual. It is caused by bacteria which are not in the frame of reference of the individual at all. Bacteria is insidious. It is so tiny that it is almost like a thetan and can be very easily, reactively confused with the progress of a thetan. It seems to have individuality. It seems to have a number of characteristics which are native to life itself and which seem to be more pertinent and more interesting than the actual body. An individual seeking to communicate with this disease as it touches some part of his body discovers something very interesting, if he cares to discover it. He unmocks the body just ahead of the disease and so accelerates its progress. Remember, communication as is. That part of the anatomy will as is, which is more native to the individual. Therefore, the individual, in seeking to communicate with the pain of the disease, actually, too many times, communicates with the body itself just ahead of the disease and so unmocks the body at that point and permits the disease to make further progress. Look at that for a moment, and I think you will understand a great deal more about healing. If you understand healing, you will have understood one of the many things which Scientology could assist to clarify. If we conceive man at large as something which is resisting the incursion of things antipathetic to man, we will discover something quite interesting, that if we insist on communicating into the area which is being hit, and insist only on communicating into that area, hit or miss, willy-nilly, we will all too often only unmock that part of man which is the front against the evil at that area. You see this? The conduct of a general when a battle is engaged is fortunately inhibited by the fact that the battle itself cuts many communication lines. One time, the chief of a squadron of bombers, very early in the war, at an outpost, was under duress to do this and to do that and to do something else. Orders, 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 not really communication. Orders, orders, orders to do this, to do that, to send out a bunch more planes into an impossible place and to do this and to do that with them, so on. In order to get the war fought, this man piled a great many 5-gallon cans of gasoline underneath his radio tower and set them off and destroyed his communication with Central Command. He was doing what he could. He was doing a great deal with a very little. And the interference he was getting in the conduct of his job was so tremendous that he himself was being unmocked faster by the high command than by the enemy. I myself, in the following months, was in the North Atlantic. And it was the practice every time some corvette officer or squadron leader sneezed for the high command to throw him out of command. Pull him off the job. Change officers. And when they finally got in a bunch of stuffed shirts, then the submarines really had a picnic. What was this high command doing? It was unmocking the point of contact as the easiest point to communicate when the high command really thought it was trying to unmock the enemy. Do you see this? It was so easy to pull off the CO of a corvette or a squadron leader. It was so easy, because things weren't going exactly right, to knock out your own forces and leave the enemy intact. You see, that is an insidious thing. High command sitting in a very safe locale, unable to influence the situation at all, except through the communication lines to his own people. No admiral or general there had his hands on a single gun. They didn't have any broad understanding of the situation. We even received dispatches, which were fascinating, fascinating dispatches. As close as they came to contacting the enemy was issuing a Navy Department directive to the effect that submarines could not travel faster than 8 knots underwater. We clocked them continually at 16.5 knots and reported the matter. But the submarines, unfortunately, did not receive that directive. We did. Now, when we speak of communication, we must then speak of communication into the area of interbulence, not to those things which we have the closest contact with. Sounds odd, doesn't it? But here we have an intimate problem, which is easily seen on the first dynamic in relationship to disease. The individual keeps contacting the point of infection, and he keeps unmocking his own troops. He is compulsively and obsessively doing this. You understand? He is putting his attention on that area and making it painful. And that pain and the electronic surges which are coming away from that pain are actually eroding and corroding the area in its vicinity. One of the things you can do is take his attention off of it entirely and leave the troops in the area, the cells, to combat the thing as best they can. You follow me? Might be kind of a new look to you, but it's actually the exact anatomy of how to communicate wrongly. Now, individuals are always communicating wrongly. In comes a force. They brace their attention against this force. And they lock it right there in place. And when they compounded these bracings, time after time, time after time, they of course have a ridge, which carries in that ridge the pattern of the infection which was attacking at that time. And so we get a continuation of the illness. Predisposition actual attack, precipitation, and continuation, perpetuation, is the course of disease on a psychosomatic level. Predisposition, precipitation, perpetuation. And how is this done? Predisposition, the individual has considered and conceived a weakness in that area. You have that? He's conceived a weakness in that area. Precipitation is the actual contact of some hostile and alien force or entity in that area. Perpetuation, his activity in continuing to resist that force by communicating with his own most communicable point in the area and continuing to avoid the hostile ingress, which is now there in picture form. This is the cycle of a psychosomatic illness. This is the cycle of an illness in a society. This is the cycle of an illness on any of the dynamics. Individual conceives a weakness and prepares to do something about it and braces people up about it, and they get afraid one way or the other. And then all of a sudden something rises up and hits that area. And then the society at large begins to resist that area at that point, and all they do is unmock their own troops. Why? It's because they have conceived the idea of an hostile force. That's the totality of the rationale. You could say their tolerance for action, motion, or motionlessness has dropped to a point where they can consider something to be another identity. Do we follow this? In other words, their pan-determinism has dropped. As long as pan-determinism, to some degree, is capable of an understanding of an hostile force, that hostile force is being communicated with. When the hostile force to the organism is thoroughly understood, it is as easily communicated with as the troops at the point. And if an individual in command of anything had sufficient pan-determinism, all he would have to do is take enough understanding of the enemy itself and enough determinism of the enemy itself to stop the war. And the war would stop. It is only a nation's continuance of orders to resist at certain points and along certain fronts which continues a war. The nation itself does not conceive that the best point of contact is the other point which is enforcing the force upon its own troops. The rightful line of conduct of a nation is for that nation to continue in communication with the head of the hostile nation and leave the troops out of it. This was conceived in World War I to such a degree that amongst British and American soldiers, a series of beautiful mock-ups were in circulation. They had this wonderful idea of how to finish the war. They were going to take their generals and the enemy generals and put them all in an arena with the soldiers scattered through the stands and give those two generals dressed in loincloths a couple of clubs, and the ones that won, well, that would have been the ones that won. They kept talking about this longingly. Actually, they weren't looking quite high enough. The governments involved should have stayed in communication with the heads of the governments involved, and so the war would have been over. There was a fellow one time who, according to German militarists, this is a very, very wonderful thing. I mean, the German militarist is the very, very best in the world. You understand this. You know this. The German militarist has no peer as a militarist. He has no peer whatsoever. There is none better. He says so himself. Must be true. And there's only one slight flaw in his militarism. He never wins wars. But, of course, this is a side point. He's a fine militarist, though. But I'm afraid that a fine militarist never wins wars. And I think that's his fate, to never win. And so he keeps on being a militarist and makes a birth in the society for militarism. All right, we get this interesting picture of the very fine militarist in Germany, holding this odd belief that a fellow by the name of Alexander, known still in India as Iskander of the Two Horns. Women in India still frighten their babies to bed and to sleep by saying that Iskander of the Two Horns will get them. Well, nobody has really researched into who Iskander is, but it is Alexander. Alexander the Great, 300 and something B.C. And they have said, these German militarists, that this man was no tactician. He was no strategist. He simply won all the battles he ever fought. But he was not a tactician or a strategist. Must have been the fine generals that were trained for him by Philip, his father, that brought him into this point of victory. Now, I'm afraid that Alexander would not be understood by the German militarist, because Alexander kept winning and the German militarist never has and never will win. Alexander, I bring up here, has only one point of great interest for us. He never avoided or fell away from the theory that the best way to end a battle was to conceive that the battle was between himself and the enemy commander. He never conceived that it was between his troops and the enemy troops under his direction. Now, do you see that that would be a via which would make a battle unwinnable? For a general to conceive that the battle was being fought by his troops under his direction against the enemy troops, you see? There's no point of end then in that battle at all. But Alexander never had this idea. He simply had the idea, rather bullheaded, that the thing to do if his troops were engaged in action was to immediately seek out the enemy general and kill him or capture him at once. And so some million and a quarter Persians, some such number, Persians were confronting a rather small handful of trained Greeks under Alexander's command, and Alexander with his companion cavalry simply rode through the contesting lines and rode through the bodyguard of the enemy general and put Darius to flight. And that was the end of that battle. It stopped at once. That was also the end of the Persian empire. Bang. Sudden, quick, effective. Now, Alexander was evidently no slouch about this sort of thing, because he made immediate political peace with the Persians by marrying all of Darius's wives. This man was no slouch. He had tremendous instincts. His pan-determinism was very great. We don't know whether Alexander really intended to rule the world or not, but he certainly did intend to do something. You know, he intended to have action, and he intended that he should remain in the action. He intended this. It was only the eventual failure of his troops to walk that far that kept him from going all the way around, I guess. Or we probably would have had a Greek government in Central America. Because he wasn't getting tired. And maybe the troops were upset because he never let them fight long enough. The turning point in his career, by the way, is he and two other soldiers captured a town by having someone in the deepest India, by having himself and a couple of other soldiers thrown over the wall. And he landed in the midst of the hostile soldiery and opened the gates from within, and that was that, and they captured the town. His troops by this time felt pretty bad. He was kind of cut up a little bit, and they took advantage of him and decided they'd all go home. And they went home to something that was not very beloved by Alexander, which was total political factionalism. He was obviously a good soldier. He won wars. But he might have had many other drawbacks. But nevertheless, when we speak of disease and so forth, it would be very interesting to look at that pattern of strategy. He never bothered around where the pain was pressing against the body. See, he would immediately attack the hostile force itself. In other words, he did not continue to communicate with the point of pain. Very important. Because continued communication with the point of pain simply unmocks your own troops at that point. A la the Northeast Sea Frontier Command of early submariner and a submarine warfare days in the Atlantic, as per any other military situation, like the bomber captain that finally blows up his radio tower so he can get a war fought. Nobody in this last war evidently ever thought of getting into close communication or in trying to communicate thoroughly with the enemy powers involved. I don't think a war could have existed if we'd really gone into communication as governments with the governments involved in the thing. People say, well, you couldn't do business with Hitler. Well, that's true enough. But they were saying at the same time you couldn't talk to him. That's kind of a fatal statement, isn't it? I think the man could be talked to. I think he could have been talked to. I think any swami with the right size turban could have walked in and unswamied him from his whole empire. I mean, the man was a punk. See, I mean, just nobody tried. All right, where you have an hostile force confronting you, which is liable to overwhelm you, and you feel that this is a battle you cannot afford, completely aside from the game, the place to be is 3 feet back of the enemy's head, changing his mind. Well, we say this thing called disease has no head. How can you be 3 feet back of it? How do you know that? How are you so sure of that? No, I'm afraid the efficient thing to do is done by preventive medicine, which goes out and puts very efficient, goes out and damps out the ingress of the germ itself. It prevents the epidemic from spreading. It takes the rats off the ships and doesn't let them bring in bubonic plague. You see, that's a very, very forward look at the thing. Now, we evidently have open to us, to be explored, this interesting fact, that it may be that there is a head 3 feet to get in back of for diseases of one kind or another. Now, I've run some experiments on this, and they are fascinating experiments. They belong in parascientology. I had a fellow one time that was very sick from bad fish. So I went and contacted the spirit of all fish and found out that he loved bad fish because people who ate fish then got sick. And we ran out the rancor by the person who had eaten the bad fish, ran out the rancor of the spirit of fish, the spirit of herring it was, toward him. And his stomach got well immediately. That's curiosa, isn't it? Almost mystic mumbo jumbo. Maybe it is and maybe it isn't. But I'm just showing you there's a door open for exploration into a field which hasn't been well looked at. Instead of making a big political issue out of chalk or pock or mock polio vaccine, maybe somebody ought to try to find the head to get 3 feet in back of that creates this thing called polio. See? There might be such things. Experimentally, there is evidently such a thing as the spirit of man and the spirit of woman. These evidently, to some slight degree, can be contacted by individuals. There seem to be some communication lines here, but let me show you the fact that a nation at war does not really believe that it is possible to communicate with the nation's head with which it is at war. You see, nations at war have the same idea that we have with relationship to disease. There may be no head to get 3 feet in back of, you see. Some mild effort is made by the heads of nations now and then, misguidedly, to get into better communication during war. And they have parleys and all kinds of things and conferences. But usually these conferences are to be found at a low level. They're at the level of contending troops. And they're very seldom in history has there been a conference between the heads of nations which are actively at war. They even break off their diplomatic relations. That's the last thing they ought to do. If the Laplanders were to suddenly declare war on any nation I had anything to do with, I would insist that its embassy be immediately invested and posted, and that the Lapland ambassador be retained at his post. I would just insist on this. I wouldn't let him out of there alive. I'd insist that he had a good solid telephone line and a good cable system that went right straight through to the head of the Lapland government. And we would start keeping it busy. And we'd keep it real busy. And I think the war would probably unmalt. But the style used is the same style used by the individual combating disease. What we do is give the ambassador his passports and tell him to shove off. The last thing we should do is cut the communication line to the head or other control of the disturbance. Well, actually, we have fought through this so often, and we have so seldom discovered the head of the contending force that we, 90% of the time, believe that it is not to be located. We merely speculate on it on a figure-figure basis. We don't actively go out and look for it. Now, the oddity is today we have a process which locates it. And if it exists, it exists. And if it doesn't exist, it doesn't exist. This process, sooner or later, would tell us where it was, what it was that headed up the forces behind a disease, that headed up the forces behind the nation, what were the actual central communication points of the contender. There is such a process. In the national level, we'd get some fairly able preclear, and we'd keep telling him, now, what don't you know, or tell me something you can not know about the head of the Lapland Nation? And we would just plow right up the line through that unknowingness until we had it. And that would be the end of that war. I wonder if the same type of exploration could not be conducted against some of the diseases which make human life rather miserable. Because let me assure you that a disease is not really any great asset. Disease was so bad a few decades ago. It's almost that bad now, but it was so bad a few decades ago that we find most of the mock-ups knocking off about the time they started to get in stride. Very young. We go up to some of these old cemeteries and we find some of the tombstones, and we look through these tombstones, why we find, if we add up the dates on them, we find he was dead at 26 and somebody else was dead at 28, and so on. Quite interesting. When you figure out what you did between the times you were 28 and 35, you will see there was quite a little span of livingness there that was very interesting and was kind of young livingness too, you know. Of course, none of the ladies present will be able to do that. But the difficulty of disease is that it makes this game with bodies almost unplayable. Almost unplayable. And we've lived with that fact for so long, so constantly, that we avoid it. We say, well, death is inevitable. It's all inevitable. People are beginning to think that about A and H bombs. A and H bombs are inevitable. We all die. Got a real apathy going on this subject of disease. But you would be utterly flabbergasted to realize what a role illness plays in human energy and activity as a suppression of the immediate game. It's a fantastically large role. Here are these bodies trying to walk forward against hostile forces, which forces are not playing the same game that the bodies are playing. See, this is one of these weirdies. Those people who, with considerable heroism, have confronted up this enemy, have usually fought pretty much alone. Their organizations are not large. They do not occupy a great deal of man's interest or attention. Mainly because man conceives the whole problem to be kind of unsolvable anyhow. there really nothing much can be done about it. Half the time, he'd just as soon lie in bed as call for a healer, because he feels apathetic about it. You know, he'd just as soon lie there. He'd get well anyhow, no reason to send a doctor. He could be well in 24 hours. He's very surprised sometimes to find out that he, with a little assistance on the line, why, he recovers rather rapidly. But this is quite a thing, the tiredness which comes over people, the accumulation of various attitudes toward others, the feeling that you mustn't let somebody breathe on you, just that you mustn't be touched by somebody else. All of these things really stem from disease. It's the communication breaker. And it's the principal communication breaker in this society. They used to talk about the four horsemen. Four horsemen. And of those four horsemen, the two that are most important as in the society that break down communications, and therefore the society itself, are, of course, disease and war. And these two things are real bad communication breakers. We see national governments going out of communication with their people today on the basis of security. They don't even know what security is. I asked a security officer one day, I said, define security. Dirty trick on my part to take a level 3 process, you know, and just chuck it at him. I said, define security for me. And he said, her, hum, yap, yap, nonsense, junk, via, and so on. I left him in complete apathy. I just unmocked his whole game. He was a security officer. He was supposed to be in charge of the security of a very important government department, and he didn't know what it was, and he had never known that he didn't know. All he thought you did was make sure that nobody present had been members of this antipathetic or subversive organization or not. He thought that was what you did, and that was that, and that was his job. As a consequence, of course, there was no security. Security is an effort to safeguard the future for an individual or group. It's an activity or an effort for the goal of safeguarding the future for an individual or group. That's what security is. But it's interpreted today to mean a cut communication line. You cut all lines, you have security. My, my, that's a succumb vector. If you cut all lines, you have death. And the goal of security is supposedly life. Fascinating how we could get a reverse on this. Government departments start falling out of communication with each other because of security. This is security and that is security. What security means to them is a cut communication. It means a classification. It says top secret, secret, confidential, restricted, can be read only by the maids in this corridor sort of thing, you know. But the odd part of it is that's intra-departmentally, but interdepartmentally, we have another thing entirely. We have the department itself unable to maintain communication with itself because its security lines are so rigid. There they can enforce them because they are all in good communication, you see, so they can enforce the communication. You get the idea? So the communication, the last communication that it gets enforced is absolute security. After that, there's no communication. We have silence. But remember, from a standpoint of communication, we can always enforce a little less communication. It's hard to enforce more communication. And that's the anatomy of a dwindling spiral. You get this. We conceive a department head of the Biscuit Examination Service, an important government department, something called the Biscuit Examination Service. And we have the head of this department saying to the remainder of the department, you know, no further messages on the subject of red biscuits will be circulated. So they say, okay, no further messages on the subject of red biscuits, that's an easy one. And they all receive this, you know. Now, next when he says, no further messages on the subject of yellow biscuits will be circulated. And they say, well, that's a little bit harder to do, because yellow biscuits, quite a lot of yellow biscuits around. And then it all gets enforced. You see, he was able to enforce it. Why? He still had a communication line, didn't he? Now, he says, now, no further communication about various colored biscuits will be circulated. Everybody says, all right. And then he finally says, no further information about biscuits will be circulated. Information cannot be forwarded through the department. It's got the word biscuits in it. You follow me? That order isn't even received, is it? And this is the exact anatomy of cutting communication. One is always able to cut a communication line which exists. But once having cut it, it has not been so easy to build a new communication line to uncut it. So cut communication lines do not get uncut, because there's no communication line there by which to uncut them. Well, you finally get this idiocy, huh? It's a fantastic thing. But when a government starts to say security is the process of cutting communications and selecting out personnel from the organization, they are then cutting communication lines, and they are gradually leaving less and less communication lines with which to finally mock up new communication lines. And they finally go down the drain all the way. Any order which comes from the chief of the bureau is considered immediately top secret, and there's only one person in the bureau who is permitted to read a top secret message, and that is the chief of the bureau. You know this situation actually exists throughout governments? It's a real situation. One of the very important organizations in the United States has enforced security to such an extent that it is now having fantastic difficulties in trying to get through any orders to its personnel in some areas, and has left personnel in some areas without orders for 2.5 years. No existing communication line by which to build a communication line. The difficulty is getting a communication line going. After that, it's easy. You get a communication line going, and then you say more and more things will be communicated on the line, and you can communicate more and more things on the line. You're building a communication line. Well, now our job is to understand how communication lines are cut, and to understand how you build them. Now, if the communication lines to disease have been cut, as they obviously have been, to a point where there's no further cognition or understanding with those things, the origin points of disease, then how could we go about building a new communication line? The pain and violence of disease all by itself is sufficient to cut the communication lines. But maybe the pain and violence of the disease is merely a physical manifestation of cut communication lines. And so, how do you build a new line? Now, when you're working with an individual, you're also working with the entire society. That's fantastically true. You work with an individual, you're working with the entire society. That doesn't mean if you made one person superlatively clear, you would have cleared the whole society. You don't get that idea. But you're working with this individual, and he's on the communication lines of the society, and the communication lines of the society are cut in some way. So you clear him all the way up on the first dynamic and you find him cut to pieces on the third. Well, you can't make a whole individual then, can you? He comes up just so far and then, boom. So therefore, your interest has to be a third dynamic interest. You have no other choice. If you're going to achieve the goals for yourself or others, you have no choice but to assume that the third dynamic must be included. And because the third dynamic can be cut to pieces by atomic fission, which was originally thought of as giving man more power than he had before, and is now the source of most of his cut communication lines in governments, you can't stop being interested on the third dynamic. You've got to be interested on the fourth. See? If you start stringing communication lines, you've got to string them on eight dynamics, unfortunately. Or you will never make an entirely whole individual anywhere. and you will never yourself be entirely whole, as far as your ability to communicate is concerned. Now you say, is there any finite goal in processing at all, or you just get processed forever? Well, I suppose if you just ran on mechanical processes, I guess that you'd get processed forever. Processed with some understanding of where you're going and what you're doing, there's a finite end to it. You might say the infinity of the finite end of the eighth dynamic. Universes. You go across, be able to disagree with and agree with other universes. By the way, I wonder if any of you caught up with the fact that the processes of not knowingness are the process of how to fall out of agreement with a time continuum. Any of you connected that up? Not knowingness is how to get out of agreement with a time continuum with which you're in agreement, you see. You can postulate that you don't know it, and to that degree, or you are then out of its agreement and time. So you're not on its time continuum, therefore you can flip universes with this process. So it's a very necessary thing for an individual to rehabilitate. He has to be able to break off time continuum. I told you the clairvoyant went by the boards only because she never came off of her client's bank. You know, reading the bank, clairvoyance, reading the bank, reading the future, so forth. She gets all mauled up with somebody else's time track, and then she can't unknow it. See? So she can't come off the time continuum. Well, that, in essence, you'd say it'd be a broken communication. No, it's not a broken communication, because it isn't in the formula of communication. It isn't part of communication. It's above it. By unknowingness, by not knowingness as a process, we can recall, remember, reconceive, sense, or feel the further ramifications of communication, which are possible. It becomes very, very important. Therefore, this principle lets you make a whole individual. Now, as far as the suppression of disease is concerned, disease is a factor in the society which is chopping up person-to-person communications. The most flagrant thing that disease worked over, mauled, and threw into the nearest ash can was the second dynamic. And has gone to such an extent now that its creation of children is done with some forebodings, misgivings. You can't take down part of a dynamic without, to some degree, taking down all of it. You'll think I'm rabidly anti-Christian. It's not true. I'm probably the only Christian alive. You're Christians too. The oddity of a cut communication line is that it takes knowingness to put it back. Now, that's a principle I'm trying to deliver into your hands. If a communication line is cut, all you have to do is build up knowingness to then put another communication line back. You see this? Well, what would you think of a church that forbade any education, experimentation, or research, or anything like that on the subject of sex that was actively cutting to pieces knowingness on the subject of the second dynamic? What would you think of a church that did this? You'd say they were sure trying to keep a certain set of communication lines awfully cut, and therefore they were trying to keep knowingness on the subject down. They're being very effective. They say, keep down the knowingness on the subject of sex, and you, of course, keep its communication lines cut. And therefore, if we cut its communication lines thoroughly enough, get the idea? An enforced communication, again, without knowingness, is a good way to cut a communication line. It's a wonderful way to cut a communication line. It's an awfully wonderful way to unmark a terminal, too. Now, where then do we draw a line? We say an enforced communication or a cut communication, then have some parity of unworkability. All right, we take a patient who is suffering from some disease, let us say, of the foot, and we say, you've got to communicate with it. You must communicate with it. He has no choice, you see. We take an individual and put electrodes on his head and say, you, Thetan, must communicate with his head and make it sane, you know. Zzz. He never gets better. We enforce his communication. We haven't solved the problem. Therefore, communication must be a symptom of something else. Because even an enforced communication is a communication, remember. And a cut communication, by definition, is still a communication that has been cut. So, neither one of these things seem to be the answer. And that's because communication itself is the game. One must improve his ability to play the game. And communication can solve a great many things. It can do a great many things. It can produce communication lines only as long as its various parts are followed and it is in agreement with, and it follows some of the intentions and self-determinisms of the terminals involved in the communication. But above communication, there is knowingness. An enforced communication is only enforced to the degree that it is done unknowingly, without knowingness, you see. If the people on both sides of the enforced communication line actually knew about the other terminal, well, the line couldn't have been called enforced. They would probably communicate on some basis of understanding of low or great. So the factor to be repaired is knowingness or not knowingness, as the case may be. These are the factors to be repaired. This is the self-determinism to be rehabilitated. The power of choice over to know or not know. The ability to know. A knowingness sufficient to discover the proper terminals in use. An ability to know before a line is joined whether or not it is possible to join the line. And this sounds an almost imponderable impossibility into someone who knew of communication only and didn't know about knowingness standing above the ARC triangle, didn't know that we have ARC and then just above that understanding and just above that knowingness. Understanding is only a form of knowingness, remember. Knowingness is superior to that. An individual who thinks that only communication could exist and that no knowingness is ever assumed, would not then be able to solve this interesting problem on any dynamic, and a problem which is probably the central problem of problems, which is, how can you tell whether or not two terminals should be put in communication with each other unless you know they can communicate or that they are connectable? Until you have them communicate with each other, you could not possibly know, these people think, whether or not it's possible to communicate. And this you have experimentation and experience and these other factors coming in. That's all a game in itself. But with our processes and abilities, our technologies, we can do this interesting thing today. We can know, before they are joined, whether two communication terminals can be joined, and thus, knowing whether or not they can be joined before we join them, we can smooth out the understandings of both sides so that they could be joined. And that would then not be an enforced enjoining of communication terminals, wouldn't it? So it is possible for man, perhaps, to scout for, locate the founts of disease or upset in the society. It is possible for man to locate these things. And it is possible for man to discover extant terminals which he probably never knew existed. Just as he won't look at death, maybe he hasn't been looking at an awful lot of terminals. It's possible for man to do an awful lot of things that he's not been able to do before. If we know now that we can know whether or not we should join terminals before we join them. And know sufficiently so that the game communication can be engaged in with benefit and profit to all. The suppressive factor of disease I have used here as an example of a terrific unknownness as far as man is concerned, about which he has mocked up considerable knowingness. But that doesn't slight the fact that the depression and inactivity of most physical bodies does stem from the threat of or the consequences of illness. pain, illness, duress, one kind or another. Terrifically suppressive factor. A few decades ago, a little child could expect to be sick at rather regular intervals. There were all sorts of diseases around. A few of these have been blocked out, but not all of them by a long way. Now, we could know more then on this frontier. We could know more about other suppressive factors. The most suppressive factor, however, that we meet at once and immediately is the factor of man's hopelessness in the face of the problem. This is our most suppressive factor. Our technologies would all go in vain if man continued to believe forever that there was no possibility of doing anything about it at all. This is one of our chief worries in Scientology, how to set a sufficient example to do this. We have originated an idea which is quite interesting. We intend to experiment with and publish a little book which gives a bunch of the central data of Scientology. We've got to experiment with this before we know its exact form. We're going to ask the individual to discover which one of these data he could have used or could use in various spheres of knowledge in life to orient them and do better with them. And this in itself, without an auditor, would bring about a considerable amount of knowingness on various sciences by bringing about an alignment of data. If we think of the tremendous bodies of data which we have gone across and which we have never digested and oriented and which are not aligned in themselves, such as grammar school, we see that man's memory may be shut off just because he just won't tolerate that tremendous unalignment of data and its lack of system, and that the memory between lives itself may be cut off entirely because he cannot reconcile one life with another, or the bodies of data in one decade with the bodies of the data in another decade. And so we may have a brand new system of memory, a brand new system of memory which makes it possible for an individual to remember through these tremendous confused bodies of unaligned data. We have a system now looking at pictures as an effort to remember. It's not a very good system. Maybe this other system would be far superior, but it is a brand new system. All we would do would be to take the data of Scientology and ask an individual to pick out which one would better some sphere of knowledge we know him to have been through. And of course he would eventually pick them all out and align them all up, and he would feel much better about the whole thing. And maybe in this wise we have invented a new system. And if our knowingness just to this degree has become sufficiently great so that we can evolve a new, hitherto unknown or unused system which would obviate the poor communication system called the engram or the picture or the facsimile, why, then you have some idea of how far we could go with this. I just want you to look at that. That some of our knowingness about terminals, about communication, knowingness about cut and enforced communications, knowing how this could be done or is being done or is not being done, and using knowingness itself as the thin span which goes across to find if a bridge will stand, if it might not do a great deal more than what I've just said. I've given you a couple of interesting problems, a problem of disease, maybe this data about you can know before you communicate, maybe this data I've just given you about a brand new system by which an individual could sweep back through the confusions of his past and so remember clearly and be willing to remember clearly without the penalty of tremendous confusion. It's already brought about these two things. Maybe it could bring about a lot more, and to a large degree. I leave that up to you. Thank you.